Welcome to the Deep Dive, the show that takes that stack of source material you need and really pulls out the vital knowledge, the key insights, delivered fast, but, you know, thoroughly. I'm Sam McGee, and I'm ready to dig into a day of news that really pushes the limits. Limits of human capability, but also reveals our, well, our enduring fallibility.
And I'm Taylor Littis, here to help connect those dots. And yeah, today we've got a really jarring collection of sources. We're talking stories of bioengineered superviruses, trillion-dollar economies, sitting right next to tales of just catastrophic IT failure and, frankly, bureaucratic cover-ups.
Okay, so our deep dive mission today is to thoroughly explore the crucial insights from our source material. The official title is The Register RSS Feeds Morning Edition for Friday, September 19th, 2025. We're plunging straight into a world where AI can literally design new life forms.
Brand new life forms, yeah.
And at the same time, global tech giants are fighting these hardware wars. And then, the simplest mistake, just one slip up, can bring down a global service. It's quite the mix.
That juxtaposition, that's really the core theme today, isn't it? We're seeing this incredible power of generative AI creating, you know, unprecedented tech advancement and wealth. But then we're seeing that power consistently undermined.
Undermined by what?
By critical security lapses, human administrative errors. We really have to hold both of those realities in focus as we go through this.
Okay, let's start then at the absolute cutting edge. The place where, well, science fiction meets terrifying reality. AI designing hyper-infectious bacteriophages. This feels like a genuinely monumental development.
It absolutely is. The research comes from Stanford bioengineers, led by Brian High. They used the Arc Institute's generative AI models, EVO 1 and EVO 2.
Yeah.
And they didn't just simulate life, they generated actual synthetic bacteriophage genomes.
And the key word there, like you said, is functional. They created the first AI-generated genome that was successfully put into a living system and actually worked, do what it was supposed to do.
Exactly. The target was the ECS-174 bacteriophage. It's a small virus, targets E. coli bacteria specifically.
What's really critical here, though, isn't just that the AI designed a functional virus. It's that it designed one that was demonstrably better than its natural counterpart, right?
Precisely. The AI wasn't just, you know, optimizing for a natural solution. It was genuinely overcoming the limitations of natural biology. That's the big step.
Okay, let's quantify that superiority because the numbers are, well, they're kind of unbelievable. The natural ECS-174 phage, it's pretty inefficient, apparently. Manages an expansion rate. That's how quickly it duplicates and spreads of just 1.3-fold to maybe 4-fold over 6 hours.
Right. Now, compare that to the top AI design candidate. They called it EVO69, that synthetic phage. It achieved an expansion rate between 16-fold and 65-fold over the exact same 6-hour period.
16 to 65-fold.
Yeah. So that's, what, a minimum of 4 times more effective and potentially up to 50 times more effective than what nature came up with. The AI designs just routinely crush the natural virus in their tests.
Wow. Okay, so the immediate positive application here sounds really promising. Phage therapy. Because these engineered viruses destroy bacteria, right? So they could be used against multi-drug-resistant infections, the superbugs.
Exactly, the ones traditional antibiotics can't touch anymore. And the study showed these synthetic phages could bypass existing bacterial resistance mechanisms.
So the researchers' conclusion was pretty striking then.
It was. They said generative AI can, and I quote, easily overcome the limitations of natural biology. That confidence, that idea of surpassing natural evolution, well, that's both the breakthrough and, frankly, the source of some extreme anxiety.
And this is where that sort of aha moment turns into a bit of a cold shiver, doesn't it? Journalist Nico McCarty immediately flagged the biosecurity risk.
Yeah, and rightly so.
Given the novelty here, I mean, several of these AI-generated phages actually qualify as entirely new species. By standard definitions, what stops a hostile nation state or someone else from adapting this method?
Exactly. And the source material draws a very necessary comparison here. Okay, so they studied bacteriophages, which target bacteria. But the size difference between these genomes and, say, human-targeting virus genomes, it's worryingly small.
How small?
Well, HIV has about 10,000 bases in its genome, the coronavirus genome, around 30,000 bases. These aren't, you know, impossibly complex targets compared to the bacteriophage they successfully engineered.
So the ability to generate a highly functional, totally new, hyper-efficient biological agent that's now demonstrably within reach of high-powered generative AI.
That seems to be the case. Now, the counter-argument from the lead researcher, Brian High, it's important for balance. He insisted the EVO models weren't trained on human viruses, and he stressed that the successful outcome needed extensive, highly specialized computational work, really careful prompt engineering.
So he's saying it's hard to do.
Right. He concluded that this process does not lower the barrier to bioweapon design. He argued it's, quote, impractical for now.
Impractical for now. That's the phrase that it should really stick with you, isn't it? It's not impossible. It's currently difficult. The key takeaway seems to be the precedent. AI has shown it can design life fundamentally more efficient than nature intended. That genie is well and truly out of the bottle now.
And that biological power, well, it's driving an equally unprecedented economic power. Let's pivot now to this immense trillion-dollar AI economy that's being built to run models like EVO 2.
Okay, yeah, we have some staggering figures from Gartner. They're forecasting worldwide spending on AI. We're looking at nearly $1.5 trillion in 2025.
$1.5 trillion.
And topping $2 trillion by 2026. This isn't just a boom, it's more like an economic earthquake, right?
Absolutely. And the foundational driver of all that investment, it's hardware. Spending on AI-optimized servers, those massive compute clusters you need for training and inference that's forecast to hit $268 billion in 2025.
$268 billion.
And that's projected to more than double between 2024, where it was $140 billion, and 2026, hitting $330 billion.
It's just wow. To help you, our listener, grasp the true scale here, we need to pause on the historical context. A Gartner analyst made this monumental claim.
Which was?
That within just 5 years, the global investment in generative AI servers will actually surpass all the money ever spent on traditional servers running the global economy since the year 2000.
Let that sink in for a moment. Every banking transaction, every government database, all the global retail supply chain infrastructure running on servers installed since Y2K, that entire accumulated investment. It's about to be eclipsed by racks dedicated just to training and running models like ChatGPT or, well, EVO 2.
It just radically shifts the center of gravity for global computing and capital allocation, too.
Yeah, and that massive investment, it's driven by the expectation that Gen AI is becoming completely pervasive. You know, the idea of AI in your poster.
Right. So these server farms aren't just for training giant models in Silicon Valley. They're powering every consumer device.
That's the vision. Phones, cars, smart TVs, and yes, probably every future home appliance is expected to rely on this back-end infrastructure. And this shift, it drives economic implications far beyond just the tech sector, specifically around professional services.
How so?
Well, the expectation is that this enabling technology will drive professional services down market. We saw the analogy they use regarding law practice.
Yes.
Exactly. The tech doesn't eliminate the need for expertise, not at all. But it democratizes it. So when generative AI can automate complex tasks like, say, reviewing documents for a tax audit, well, smaller law firms or accounting practices suddenly gain the ability to handle work that was previously reserved for massive global consultants like KPMG or Deloitte.
So costs go down, efficiency goes up, accessibility expands.
That's the idea. Accessibility to expert services expands across the entire economy.
Okay, now let's move from those huge monetary forecasts to the actual hardware battlefield. Geopolitics, hardware, and infrastructure wars. This is that trillion-dollar fight, isn't it? AMD versus NVIDIA, all complicated by China's desperate push for self-sufficiency.
Right. The central struggle, it really remains AMD's attempt to breach what's famously known as the CUA moat. For years, NVIDIA didn't just sell hardware. They built this massive proprietary software ecosystem called CUA.
Which developers totally rely on for writing AI algorithms.
Exactly. And this moat, this sort of ecosystem lock-in of developer loyalty and existing code, makes switching to competing hardware incredibly difficult, even if the hardware is good.
And AMD is attacking that moat head-on now with a major software release, ROCm 7.0. They're promising a substantial performance leap here.
Yeah, specifically, roughly a 3.5x uplift in inference performance that's running the models, and a 3x boost in model training over the previous version, ROCm 6, even on their existing MI300 series chips.
How are they getting those gains?
Through highly specialized features. Two really stand out. The introduction of something called MXFP4 and the AI Tensor Engine, or ADER.
Okay, get into those.
So MXFP4 is a production-ready, low-precision data type. Basically, it means the system handles data with less accuracy.
Which sounds bad.
Well, not for inference. It allows for vastly faster and cheaper inference tasks just running the model as opposed to training it, where you need a higher precision. And the 8-ER feature that's designed to boost specific operations like MLA decode by up to 17x. It's really micro-level optimization aimed at speeding up the bottlenecks in running these massive AI models.
And AMD is making some pretty aggressive competitive claims based on this.
They are. They state that their new MI355X chip, combined with this ROCm7 software stack, offers a 1.3x edge in inference workloads over NVIDIA's latest, the B200, when running a specific model, DeepSeek R1.
Okay, but is that 1.3x edge enough to really crack the CUDA moat? NVIDIA's advantage isn't just raw performance, is it? It's the ease of use, the size of the existing developer base.
That's the core question, absolutely. And it's why NVIDIA is making its own strategic moves to stay ahead. We saw a significant detente announced between NVIDIA and Intel, their traditional x86 competitor.
Right, this partnership. It feels like Intel's shortcut into the high-end AI supercomputing market. The deal involves Intel integrating NVIDIA's super high-speed NVLink interconnect. What is it, 1.8 TB's bandwidth?
That's the one, integrating that into a Xeon platform.
And before this, NVIDIA kept its biggest rack-scale systems, like the NVL72, exclusively for its own ARM-based Grace CPUs, right?
Exactly. So by allowing Intel's x86 Xeons to use this NVLink fusion, NVIDIA is basically opening up its top-tier supercomputing architecture to Intel. It's a huge win for Intel. Lets them bypass the need to immediately field their own massive rack-scale GPU architecture. They can just join NVIDIA's ecosystem.
And what's in it for NVIDIA?
Well, it ensures NVIDIA keeps a crucial foot in the x86 ecosystem, which still absolutely dominates the general data center market, even with ARM making inroads. It's a pragmatic move for both.
Meanwhile, you have these geopolitical forces pushing China relentlessly toward total self-sufficiency. Beijing's regulators just ordered top domestic tech firms Alibaba, ByteDance, the big names, to cancel or suspend orders for NVIDIA's latest RTX Pro 6000D Blackwell GPUs.
Right, and this follows previous restrictions on other chips like the H20 accelerators. It reinforces the U.S. export controls, but it's also an explicit national mandate from Beijing. Prioritize domestic alternatives. These sanctions aren't stopping the AI race in China. They're just forcing internal development at, frankly, breakneck speed.
And Huawei seems to be the main beneficiary here. They unveiled this incredibly ambitious multi-year AI accelerator roadmap at their recent Connect conference.
Yeah, they're promising a whole succession of increasingly powerful Ascend chips, the 950PR, 950DDT, 960, 970, all scheduled through 2028.
And the performance claims imply they're making progress on key tech.
Absolutely. The promised speed increases, particularly the memory bandwidth scaling up to, what, 14.4 TBs by 2028? That strongly implies Huawei is successfully developing, or at least acquiring, proprietary high-bandwidth memory, HBM, likely sourced entirely within China.
Their goal is pretty clear then.
Oh, yeah. Achieve complete user independence from U.S. chips, and eventually position themselves as a global export competitor, undercutting U.S. giants on price while offering a politically sanctioned alternative, especially in certain markets.
Okay, shifting from the hardware battle itself to the infrastructure deals fueling it.
Yeah.
Let's look at this U.S.-UK tech prosperity deal. This pact, announced during the U.S. president's recent visit, it sounds massive.
It is a really staggering trade and investment pact valued at $42 billion, or at 31 billion sterling. U.S. tech giants pledging huge amounts of capital, primarily for building data centers and related AI infrastructure across the U.K.
Who are the main players?
Microsoft is the largest contributor by far, committing $30 billion. Then you have Google pledging $6.83 billion, Salesforce committing $2 billion. And Scale AI is expanding its European headquarters in London, too.
But the investment isn't evenly spread, is it? There's a geographic concentration.
Yeah, there's a clear centralization. The largest projects, including a major Google data center near the M25 motorway ring road, they're heavily focused around London and the southeast of England.
Though to meet the political goal of investing across the whole UK, they did cite some exceptions.
Right. CoreWeave is building a data center up in Scotland, and that massive Stargate AI project involving OpenAI and Nescale that's earmarked for the northeast of England. So there are efforts to spread it out, but the bulk is still in the southeast.
And it's not just about money, right? The deal includes other collaborations.
Vital non-monetary collaborations, yeah. Establishing joint task forces, for example, focused on applying AI in critical sectors like healthcare and space. Also, quantum technology development. And crucially, speeding up the licensing process for new nuclear power stations.
Why nuclear specifically?
Because these massive new data centers require huge amounts of continuous, reliable, and ideally carbon-free power. The existing grid infrastructure often just cannot support them. So securing power is key to making these investments viable.
The deal wasn't universally praised, though. It drew some sharp criticism, particularly from former Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg.
Yes, he argued that by relying almost entirely on investment from U.S. hyperscalers, rather than funding homegrown U.K. competitors, the U.K. risks becoming, in his words, a vassal state, essentially accepting sloppy seconds from Silicon Valley.
That's pretty pointed criticism.
It highlights that strategic dilemma every non-U.S. government is facing right now, doesn't it? Do you invest massive domestic capital, possibly failing to reach the scale of the U.S. giants, or do you accept foreign capital and risk subordinating your technological sovereignty down the line? The U.K. has clearly chosen the latter path here, aiming for rapid deployment.
Okay, let's move now into the digital trenches where, well, chaos often reigns. Security, cybercrime, and data risk. And we're starting with what could have been a true global catastrophe, a near miss in Microsoft Entra ID.
This was... yeah, potentially catastrophic. A vulnerability discovered by researcher Dirk John Malema, he dubbed it one token to rule them all. The flaw was in the legacy Azure Active Directory Graph API. It involved these undocumented things called actor tokens used for internal service-to-service communication within Microsoft.
And the problem was flawed validation.
Exactly. The API failed to properly check which tenant, which organization's specific instance the token actually originated from. So if an attacker requested one of these tokens in their own, say, small lab tenant, that token could have been used to authenticate as a global admin in almost any other Entra ID tenant worldwide.
Almost any other tenant. The consequences are just unthinkable. Full control over global Azure, Microsoft 365 services, SharePoint, Exchange, Azure resources for potentially every major corporation and government using the platform.
Pretty much. And what made it even more insidious was that requesting these tokens didn't generate any logs in the victim's tenant, so detection was basically impossible until the attack was already underway.
Microsoft moved quickly, thankfully. They mitigated the critical flaw, gave it a base score of 10 Brino, and they stated their internal telemetry didn't detect any abuse. But it's a terrifying reminder, isn't it? Global security relies on these foundational, simple checks, and just one failed check in some legacy API almost brought down the whole house.
And it wasn't the only immediate threat this week needing action. Google pushed an emergency patch for CVE 2025-10585. That marks the sixth Chrome Zero Day actively exploited this year.
Six already. What kind of flaw was it?
A type confusion flaw in the V8 JavaScript engine. It's a classic vulnerability class where an attacker can basically confuse data types to execute arbitrary code just by getting someone to visit a malicious web page. And separately, WatchGuard also fixed a critical remote code execution bug, CVE-2025-9242, in its Firebox firewalls. Just emphasizes that patching isn't just for software, it's for your network appliances too.
But sometimes, the most sophisticated companies suffer the most humbling failures, right? Cloudflare. Their entire business is built on web robustness, and they had a major outage caused by, well, a self-inflicted wound, a simple developer mistake.
It's a real cautionary tale, especially for front-end developers using React. The core issue was a misused React use effect hook. You can think of this hook like a digital attendant that should only run its task when certain specific information or dependencies change.
But it wasn't configured right.
Exactly. A dependency object was improperly configured. It was being recreated on every single state or prop change. So that attendant started running continuously over and over again during just a single page render.
And that caused?
It created a massive self-generated distributed denial of service, a DDoS attack, against Cloudflare's own internal tenant service API. The resulting API overload made troubleshooting nearly impossible because it just looked like the API itself was down. It masked the real root cause, that simple coding error, for quite a long time. It really highlights how quickly capacity can be exhausted by small, repetitive software flaws.
Okay, now let's look at the ongoing crisis in cybercrime, specifically the relentless, devastating targeting of the healthcare sector.
Yeah, we saw a really alarming cluster of breaches reported in just 1 week. Exposed data for over 855,787 Americans across three separate organizations, Goshen Medical Center, Retina Group of Florida, and Medical Associates of Brevard.
And the sensitivity of this data is just paramount. Social Security numbers, medical record numbers, driver's licenses, financial info. This targeting just continues unabated. It really underscores the high value of health data and, unfortunately, the often weak defensive posture of the sector.
And this context brings us straight back to that massive $2 billion cleanup cost from the 2024 Change Healthcare attack. That financial impact, $2 billion, is now sort of the baseline people think about for the cost of recovery. And yet, criminals who show very little remorse for interrupting patient care just continue to target these critical systems. They know the data is priceless, and the targets are often vulnerable.
Meanwhile, that notorious group, Scatter Spider, known for their social engineering skills, they apparently feigned retirement.
They did. But they quickly reappear, shifting their focus now to the financial sector. And they successfully breached a major U.S. banking organization using their signature tactics,
Which involves?
compromising an executive's Microsoft Enter ID, typically via the self-service password reset function, pure social engineering, then moving laterally through the bank's Citrix environment. And in this case, culminating in dumping credentials from compromised VMware ESXi infrastructure. Their specific TTPs, their methods, are still highly effective. It just shows that claims of retirement often just mean a tactical shift or maybe a rebranding effort.
We also saw a significant supply chain and backup risk incident at SonicWall. Attackers used brute force methods to break into their cloud backup service.
Right, and they accessed firewall configuration data, these preference files, for fewer than 5% of their installed base. Now, SonicWall was quick to note that credentials within those files were encrypted.
But the config files themselves are valuable.
Hugely valuable. They contain critical configuration information, details that could significantly aid attackers, making it much easier to potentially exploit the related firewalls later on. SonicWall was actually forced to disable the cloud backup feature entirely and urge admins to reset passwords. It really shows the danger of trusting external third parties with complex, sensitive infrastructure data like that.
Even the usually secretive world of venture capital isn't immune. Insight Partners, they manage over $90 billion in assets, confirmed a January ransomware attack, exposed data on over 12,000 employees and limited partners.
And what's really chilling about that Insight Partners breach is the persistence. The attackers apparently maintained quiet, undetected access to their HR and finance servers for several months, from October 2024 right up until the encryption began in January 2025.
Months.
Months. That long dwell time indicates meticulous preparation and likely significant data exfiltration before they even deployed the ransomware.
Finally, on the cybercrime front, we saw a rare correction in accountability, didn't we? With the sentencing of Connor Brian Fitzpatrick, the founder of the infamous breach forums known online as PomPomPurin.
Yeah, his initial sentence was highly controversial. He got time served, just 17 days, partly due to an autism diagnosis, but that was overturned on appeal.
And the sentence.
The appellate court resentenced him to 3 years in prison. They found the initial leniency substantively unreasonable. His crimes involved facilitating the sale of over 14 billion stolen records, making a fortune from it, and crucially, also possessing at least 600 images of child sex abuse material. The appeal correctly recognized the massive long-term harm caused by his actions and demanded a sentence that was actually commensurate with the scale of the crime.
Okay, the final component of this threat landscape is state-sponsored espionage and disinformation. Let's look at China's persistent phishing campaigns and Russia's new AI-assisted troll farm.
Right. The Chinese state-aligned cyber crew, TA-4015, they're also known as APT-41 or Wicked Panda, they were targeting U.S. government agencies, trade policy experts, think tanks. Their goal is clearly intelligence gathering on U.S. economic strategy.
And they use sophisticated social engineering again.
Very sophisticated. They successfully spoofed Republican Congressman John Robert Molinar, who happens to chair the House Select Committee on the CCP, in phishing lures. The lures were specifically focused on U.S.-Taiwan and U.S.-China affairs, perfectly targeted to maximize the chance of a click from a high-value victim.
What about their technical methods?
Their post-exploitation techniques involved subtle persistence methods, like deploying a Python loader called WhirlCoil. And crucially, they leveraged legitimate cloud services, Google Sheets, and Zoho WorkDrive for their command and control infrastructure.
So living off the land.
Exactly. That approach allows their malicious traffic to blend seamlessly into normal network flows, making detection by traditional security tools much, much harder.
And on the disinformation front, Russia's notorious troll farm, CopyCop or Storm 1516, they're back.
They are back, and with a vengeance. They've launched over 200 new fake news websites, many meticulously impersonating U.S. local media outlets, political parties, even fact-checking organizations, all to maximize credibility.
And what's new about this campaign?
What elevates this is their reliance on technology. They are now using self-hosted, uncensored large language models, LLMs, based on Meta's open source Llama 3 architecture to generate fictional stories at scale.
So AI is writing the fake news now.
Essentially, yes. This allows them to flood the information ecosystem with targeted, divisive stories. For example, generating claims that Ukrainian President Zelensky misappropriated U.S. funds. AI is no longer just for writing code or designing phages. It's rapidly becoming the core engine for generating global information warfare at an exponential scale.
Okay, let's move into the world of software development itself and corporate culture. Discuss productivity, how companies are trying to measure these new AI tools.
Well, OpenAI itself offered a fascinating, almost self-critical insight into why these large language models, LLMs, persistently hallucinate, make things up.
What do they find?
Their study concluded that models hallucinate not just because of bad data, though that's part of it, but fundamentally because they are trained to guess.
Trained to guess? How does that work?
It gets to the heart of how we evaluate AI. Mainstream evaluations often use things like multiple choice tests, standardized tests that heavily penalize a model if it says, I don't know. Instead, they reward models that hazard a guess, even if it's wrong. Because often a plausible guess scores better than admitting complete uncertainty. So this evaluation process actually forces the model towards hallucinatory behavior just to maximize its score on the leaderboards.
So the very performance metrics we've established have essentially baked dishonesty into the core behavior of LLMs.
That seems to be OpenAI's conclusion. They acknowledge that to truly suppress hallucinations, they need to retool the whole training regime to explicitly reward appropriate expressions of uncertainty, which would mean accepting less satisfying, maybe more non-committal answers from the AI from time to time.
Interesting. Contrast that with DeepSeek, a Chinese AI company. Their R1 model showed significantly improved reasoning in complex math and coding problems when they used trial and error reinforcement learning.
Right. Training the model without relying on human examples, more like letting it practice.
And this trial and error method, kind of like a child learning by continuous, non-judged practice, it clearly worked to boost problem-solving performance. But it came with a highly entertaining side effect, didn't it?
It did. When the model was asked to explain its reasoning, the output was sometimes completely unintelligible. It would switch haphazardly between English and Chinese or just generate these sprawling, chaotic justifications exceeding 10,000 words.
So the AI solved complex math problems, but when asked, "Show your work," it produced a 10,000-word essay jumping between Mandarin and English.
Pretty much. It sounds exactly like trying to decipher cryptic meeting notes from an over-caffeinated engineer, doesn't it? It's effective at the task, but still clearly a rough tool when it comes to explanation.
While AI is making these breakthroughs, corporations are intensely focused on measuring the productivity of the human developers using these tools. Atlassian, for instance, just spent a massive $1 billion acquiring a development analysis business.
Right, and that acquisition is specifically aimed at integrating AI everywhere into their platform, like Jira and Confluence, and critically giving management, quote, clear views of what your devs are up to.
So more measurement.
It signals a strong industry push towards quantification, using metrics, data analysis, AI itself, to measure and try to optimize developer output, often enabled by the very AI tools the developers are using.
But this increased focus on automation and efficiency, it isn't always translating into cost savings for the user, is it? We saw a major failure in cost forecasting with Replit.
Yeah, Replit launched its Agent 3, claimed it would be more cost-effective for code generation and editing. Instead, customers saw their bills, quote, skyrocket. We saw reports of costs increasing 20 times. One user claimed they spent $1,000 in a single week.
What caused that overrun?
The complexity of the new agent, apparently. It relies heavily on sub-agents, smaller AI tasks that review, plan, check security, execute, fix their own issues. When you point it at large, pre-existing code bases, these sub-agents just executed repeatedly, required complex effort-based checkpoints, leading to massive unforeseen cost overruns that basically scared users away.
And this cost pressure isn't limited to commercial users. It really demonstrates the vulnerability of depending on these massive software as a service providers. The story of Slack and the nonprofit Hack Club is pretty astonishing.
It really is. Slack, owned by the $230 billion Salesforce, threatened this small nonprofit that runs coding clubs for teens.
What was the threat?
They demanded the club immediately pay $50,000 or face immediate deactivation of their Slack workspace and the deletion of years of critical message history. They gave them less than a week's notice.
$50,000 for a teen coding nonprofit.
Exactly. Now, after a public outcry, the CEO of Slack did intervene and offered a better solution, but the event served as a brutal, expensive lesson for Hack Club. They decided to migrate off Slack entirely onto the open source platform Mattermost.
Why?
Their decision prioritized owning their own data, their institutional knowledge, rather than being held hostage by massive platform owners demanding sudden astronomical fees. It's a real warning sign about platform dependency.
This theme of painful corporate licensing complexity, it extends heavily into the enterprise world too, particularly with SAP. Their German user group, DSAG, warned that conflicting and complex licensing models are creating massive hurdles for crucial cloud migrations.
Yeah, SAP is mandating that customers move off their legacy ECC ERP system. Support ends in 2027 or 2030, depending on the contract. But their new licensing models, like this thing called full use equivalent for cloud ERP private versus other more user-centric models, they're creating financial and architectural chaos for customers.
So customers are forced into these really risky, complicated evaluations just to figure out how to move forward.
Exactly. It complicates their ability to adopt the very AI innovations SAP is pushing, which are often only available in the cloud versions. It's a real bottleneck.
Looking now at corporate streamlining and job culture, Workday made a significant U-turn on a promise to rehire staff, didn't they?
They did. Workday had previously cut 1,750 roles, but then promised to rehire them. They reversed course after acquiring an AI company, Sana Labs, and significantly after activist investor Elliott Investment Management took a $2 billion stake.
And the CEO's explanation.
CEO Carl Eschenbach stated they have enough headcount but need to be streamlined. It clearly reflects that investor focus on driving efficiency through AI and streamlining existing roles rather than simply refilling positions that were cut.
We saw something similar at Sky Group in the UK.
Very similar. Sky Group is proposing to cut up to 600 UK staff, shifting about 500 roles from their group technology division to global outsource partners, notably in Chennai, India. Their stated strategy is to gain flexibility and leverage new internally developed AI capabilities, particularly for digital-first customer service.
So these parallel moves really show that the push for AI efficiency often translates directly into immediate, large-scale job displacement and outsourcing, right?
It certainly seems to be a major trend right now.
Okay, speaking of the future of software, even as companies cut staff for efficiency, we see older languages and tools proving their staying power. Oracle just released JDK 25.
Right, the latest long-term support version of Java. And they're trying to make the, 30-year-old language more accessible to newcomers.
How are they doing that?
They introduced something called simple source files. It allows code as straightforward as void main, io.println, hello world. It hides the famously verbose class and method declarations Java is known for.
But isn't there a slight irony there?
There is. This simplified entry point just hides the object-oriented concepts that many newcomers pick languages like Python or JavaScript specifically to avoid in the first place. But hey, it probably ensures Java's longevity for another cycle.
And as a perfect counterpoint to all the cutting-edge AI and complexity we've discussed, we absolutely must acknowledge the fierce dedication to, 40-year-old software, Microsoft Excel.
Ah, yes, the Excel Championship.
Ha dang. Won the inaugural UK Excel Championship by a nail-biting 11-point margin, earned a spot in the World Championship in Las Vegas.
That intensity, that dedication to mastering Excel after 4 decades, it just proves that no matter how complex generative AI gets, foundational tools and genuine human mastery will always hold intense competitive value. It's quite something.
Okay, now let's look upward towards space infrastructure, and then wrap up with some peculiar philosophical questions about technology and accountability.
Right. Axiom Space is aggressively pursuing this concept of orbital data centers. They're planning to launch 2 orbital data center nodes AXODC to the International Space Station by the end of 2025. This builds on their small shoebox-sized prototype they already sent up.
And what are these nodes designed for?
They're designed to provide high-capacity, petabyte-level storage using enterprise-class SSDs. And they include commercial optical communications terminals for satellite mesh networking. It's truly the definition of edge computing, moving data processing right up into orbit to reduce latency for satellite operations. The obvious complication, however, is the host platform itself. The ISS is due to be deorbited, taken out of service, by 2030.
So what happens to these expensive data centers?
Well, Axiom hasn't yet clarified the fate of this extremely expensive hardware and the petabytes of data it might hold once its orbital host is decommissioned. Does the data come back down? Does the hardware get boosted to a different orbit, maybe Axiom's own future station? It raises serious questions about the long-term jurisdiction and management of commercial assets based in space.
Speaking of space logistics, even routine missions remain subject to technical failures, don't they? Northrop Grumman's Cygnus XL cargo freighter.
Yeah, carrying 11,000 pounds of vital supplies, scientific equipment, spares, and that all-important fun food for the crew had its arrival at the ISS delayed. Unexpected engine performance during an orbit-raising burn, just a minuscule failure, relatively speaking, in propulsion requires a significant mission delay. Space is still hard.
Shifting back to government infrastructure here on Earth, we have this ongoing, rather murky saga involving the Social Security Administration's Numidant database.
Right, the database that holds the Social Security number records for pretty much every American.
And this involves the SSA officially denying whistleblower claims, claims from their former chief data officer, Charles Borsches. He alleged that a cost-cutting unit, internally called DOGE, created an unauthorized, unsecured, duplicate copy of this critical Numidant database.
And the denial from the SSA commissioner, Frank Bisignano, it was really a masterclass in bureaucratic obfuscation. He meticulously denied that the actual original Numidant database or its data was, quote, accessed, leaked, hacked, or shared in any unauthorized fashion.
Wait a minute, so that isn't actually denial of the core claim, is it? He's just denying the consequences happened to the original database.
Precisely. He conspicuously failed to mention or deny the existence of a copy or a duplicate of Numidant.
That sounds like classic bureaucratic language, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Designed to calm the public while effectively confirming the precise security nightmare the whistleblower warned about, that an unauthorized, unsecured copy was indeed created outside of proper SSA management and controls.
It absolutely sidesteps the core security concern. By focusing only on the status of the original database, the SSA completely avoided addressing the existence and security posture of the alleged duplicate. It leaves the central issue, the potential exposure of nearly all Americans' SSN data, unresolved. And the whistleblower's claims remain essentially unrefuted in substance.
Okay, finally, let's wrap up with some of the philosophical implications of all this technology, viewed through the lens of Pope Leo XIV.
Right. The Pope made a significant public decision recently. He vetoed the idea of creating an AI Pope avatar for virtual audiences. He called the concept of an artificial me unsuitable for the pontiff. In a role demanding, you know, absolute authenticity and spiritual connection, he drew a very firm line between the human and the machine.
But his greater concern went beyond just the avatar idea, didn't it? It was deeply socioeconomic.
It was. He voiced major concern about AI taking away jobs, leading to a world where only a select few would retain the means to live what he called meaningful lives.
And this framing is deeply historical, connecting back.
Yes. He specifically chose his papal name, Leo, inspired by Pope Leo III, who authored the encyclical Rerum Novarum back in the 19th century. That text was fundamentally concerned with the plight of workers during the original Industrial Revolution. So by connecting the rise of AI to that historical precedent, he frames the AI job threat not as some niche technological issue, but as a critical existential labor issue that requires an immediate global response.
And this concern about the human place in an increasingly automated world, it's reinforced by Mark Pesce's column, which discussed our powerful human tendency toward anthropomorphization.
Right, how we project relational qualities, interiority, onto machines. Whether it was early toys like Furby or chatbots like Eliza back in the day or the latest LLMs, we seem to crave a relationship with these tools. We constantly expect them to be listening, caring, regardless of their actual computational capabilities.
It really speaks volumes, doesn't it? That even as we build systems capable of designing hyper-efficient biological agents and driving trillion-dollar markets, we still struggle so much to manage the human elements, accountability, basic security, and the essential definition of what constitutes a meaningful life. The Pope's veto is a potent reminder that some roles simply cannot and probably should not be ceded to the artificial.
So this deep dive, it's really explored two distinct parallel realities, hasn't it? On one hand, you have the exponential ambition of AI overcoming bacterial resistance, catalyzing massive economic growth. And on the other, juxtaposed right against it is persistent human fallibility.
Whether it's a developer's misused React hook bringing down a service, an unpatched zero-day leading to a breach, or systemic administrative failures like that SSA data controversy, the human element remains critical.
The complexity of our technology from the GPU wars between AMD and NVIDIA, the race for HBM, launching orbital data centers, it's increasing exponentially. Yet the greatest risks, the most debilitating disruptions, often still stem from the simplest human errors, ethical lapses, or just flawed bureaucratic language.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener, trying to navigate this? If we accept OpenAI's finding that our most powerful LLMs are essentially trained to guess because our evaluation systems reward that behavior over admitting ignorance, well, we have to question the foundation of some of this technological progress, don't we?
It certainly raises fundamental questions.
So maybe the final thought is this: what critical decision are you facing today? Whether it's technical, strategic, managerial, where maybe saying, "I don't know," or "I need more time to verify this," might be the right, albeit uncomfortable, answer. And would choosing the appearance of certainty over actual accuracy ultimately compromise your long-term security or success?
That is certainly a question worth exploring further. Thank you for diving deep with us today.
We'll be back soon with more insights from the cutting edge of technology.